Today I'm going to talk about the square peg problem. So this is one of the topics that I've been working on since 2.5 years, and I gave several talks already, but today I want to talk about new results. Only a few of them have seen them already in Budapest, but otherwise I hope this is new and hopefully also interesting. So I will use slides and the backboard and an animation as an extra feature. So. Maybe I should begin with a definition of a Jordan curve, just to make a proper definition. So for me, a Jordan curve, or actually, is this big enough? Yeah. Otherwise, you have to come into the front. For me, this is a simple closed curve, which is continuous. Say gamma in the plane. So we are always in this talk in the plane. And so another formulation for this would be just a topological embedding of a circle S1 into the plane. That's a Jordan curve. And we say that maybe when I draw an example here, can you see this? Or what's the. Okay. Okay, so then I also say that a polygon P is inscribed in gamma if all vertices are on gamma, so basically are. On the image of gamma. So let's draw an example. So that's a Jordan curve, and I want to inscribe squares, because in this talk we are interested in inscribed squares. So for example, a nice one could be this here. And of course, there are a lot of more inscribed squares. Maybe here we also find one. And notice that at this point and here, the square also lies outside of the curve. So all we need is really that the vertices lie on the curve. That's the only condition. And then there's a conjecture by Toeplitz called the square peg problem nowadays. It's actually from 1911, so it's quite old. It's, and this year it became 100 years old. It says that every Jordan curve inscribes a square. And now let's switch to slides. So that's again the problem due to auto tuplets. This is a curve which is actually complicated. So for such a curve which has a spiral, proofs are not known or known depending on how good the spiral is. But what we know is, so this is an inscribed square. The problem is solved affirmatively for smooth enough curves. So if the curve is C1 or piecewise linear, then we know that they always inscribe squares. But otherwise, it's completely open. And why is it's basically due to the fact that there are only topological proofs known, which can't deal with very fractalin curves, which are which behave very chaotic near the boundary. And so one example, for example, is, so you might think, if we can prove it for smooth curves, then why can't we just approximate every given curve for which we want to prove that there's an inscribed curve square by smooth curves? Why can't we do an approximation argument? The thing is, if we have a given curve and we approximate it with smooth curves, and for every smooth curve we find a square which is inscribed, of course we will find a converging subsequence of those squares that we find, and the limit square will also be contained or inscribed in the given curve. The problem is just that it might be degenerate to a point. So the sequence of squares that you get may get smaller and smaller, and there's, since 100 years, no argument against this. Or why this is not a problem. Nobody knows. And a lot of people seriously worked on this. So that's history out of papers that proved it in a correct way for certain classes of curves. There are more published proofs, and as far as I know, many of them also contain, unfortunately, gaps which cannot be resolved in some sense. So these are all correct, these proofs. The first one is due to Toeplitz. It's never published. He just claimed, in a published version of a conference report of one of Toeplitz's talks, just says that he has a proof, but it's not known whether he actually does have a proof which is correct. That's also what Emsch complains about. So he found another proof independently, he claims, 2 and 4 years later, and the problem was suggested to him by Kempner, and yeah. So it's not clear actually who of those three is the inventor and who should. So I said it's Toeplitz's problem, because usually people say it's Toeplitz's problem, but it's not completely clear whether he's the origin of the problem.
Is it done for discrete polygons?
Yeah. Yes. For piecewise linear curves, it's proved. Here it is. But this follows from an approximation argument using the version for C infinity curves, for example. So if you approximate a piecewise linear curves by smooth curves, there everything goes well. So you don't need to do this. So there's a direct proof due to Igor Pak. 3 years ago, he proved that, he gave a discrete version of the proof of the square peg problem, which was, I think, the first really nice proof was due to Schnirelmann, because he proved it for smooth enough curves in general. Before that, by Emsch and Toeplitz, it was only known for convex curves. And, for example, it's interesting that Emsch says that he proved it only for smooth enough convex curves, because an approximation argument again shows that if you can prove it for smooth enough convex curves, then you can prove it for all convex curves. Schnirelmann's condition, which is a bit less than C2, so for C2 curves he has shown this, implies this also for piecewise linear curves by an approximation argument. Maybe I should show why this approximation argument does not work nicely in general. So here's just a small intuition. So for example, if the curve looks like this, and here in this point it's not smooth, we approximate it by a smooth curve, maybe like this, and then suppose we find a square here, which maybe looks like this, and at another approximation argument we find another small square, then you cannot, I mean, if the curve looks reasonably complicated, one cannot, there's no known argument so far that there exists a converging subsequence of squares which is not converging to a degenerate square, to a point. Yes? Very good question. It's in general not known. I will come back to this hopefully soon. But this would be this would of course work if you can prove, for example. So I would conjecture that if you are given a curve and which contains a large disk, Yeah, so in the interior. Now draw a square on this circle. I would conjecture that every curve that has such a square in its interior will contain, will inscribe a square of at least this size. I would conjecture this, but I have no proof. And yeah. But then, if you can prove this at least for piecewise linear curves or for smooth curves, then an approximation argument, of course, works. Because one bounded the size of the squares from below, so it cannot degenerate to a point. So so what's interesting here, it was first proved for convex curves, then Girard proved it for analytic curves, Schneeremann, Schneeremann's proof. I hope to present just the quick ideas of Schneeremann's proof. Some people say it contains an error, but it's not a dramatic one from my point of view. Fenn has also a very nice proof for convex curves, namely he has Fenn is maybe well known for his table theorem, that if you have basically some mountain, then you will find some position where a table with four legs can stand horizontally without wiggling. Okay, and this implies also this graphic problem for convex curves. And the strongest version so far was a Strömquist's version for locally monotone curves, which is the following condition. So that's what a Strömquist proof. If you have a locally monotone curve, then it inscribes a square. But what's locally monotone? Locally monotone means that at every point you find a linear functional such that in the neighborhood of this point the curve is strictly monotonely increasing with respect to this linear functional. Or in other words, you find for every point one coordinate such that if you project the curve to this coordinate, it will always increase strictly. Okay, so for those curves it's proved, and it's already quite general. But it's so for example, if you have a cusp like this, then it works because you can just use this linear functional at this point. If you have a cusp like this, then it's already not working anymore if this rotates at every point to the left. And so a new criterion is the following, which is containing Strömquist's criterion. And I always hesitated to present this because it's hard to do this on the blackboard, but with slides it works. So suppose this circle is the parameterizing circle for the curve, and this is the curve in the plane. We call a trapezoid, or a quadrilateral that is inscribed in the square, a special trapezoid of size epsilon if it's parameterized in this way. So this is the first vertex, second vertex, third vertex, fourth vertex, such that the first three edges are all of the same length, and the last edge is shorter than all the other ones. That's what I call a special trapezoid. It's just a definition that I will use just for this theorem. And then I say that, or I claim that if you have a curve without any special trapezoid of a fixed size epsilon, say epsilon is 0.001, if there exists such an epsilon such that you have no special trapezoid of size epsilon inscribed in this curve, then this curve has to inscribe a square. And actually, since this is a topological argument behind this proof, it's actually rather complicated, at least very technical. The argument shows that generically you can have an even number of special trapezoids of size epsilon inscribed, and the argument will still give you an inscribed square. And so why is this interesting? It seems still quite technical, but it's somehow an open condition. In the space of all embeddings of a circle in the plane, this is an open condition. And that's why it's also it gives also more than Stormquist's version. So, and also another point is that it holds for arbitrary metric spaces with the right definition of what a square is. So, suppose you are given a metric space, what should be a square? I would suggest the following definition. Take four points in a metric space. It's called a square if the four edges are of equal length, so A. And the two diagonals have also the same length, D and D. Okay. Okay, so much to this. Now I want to prove at least why this Toeplitz problem is true for smooth curves. And the basic reason is that the number of inscribed squares is odd. And the proof idea is due to Schniedelmann, as I mentioned before. However, he used more difficult language because the notion of a Bordism was not baptized yet at this time. But basically, his idea was a Bordism argument. So how does it work? Let P4 be the space of all four tuples of points, x1 up to x4, on the circle, such that they lie counterclockwise on the curve gamma. Okay, so this is the space of all four tuples of points that lie counterclockwise on gamma. So for example, if this is gamma, then 1, 2, 3, and 4. What I drew here are the images and the gamma of a certain element in this parameterizing space. So P is for stands for parameterizing four tuples of points on gamma. And then we define a map F from P4 to R4 by first looking at this parameterized quadrilateral, and you measure the length of all edges. This gives you four numbers in R, and then you measure two more distances, namely these diagonals. Yeah. So first you measure here the edges, and then the diagonals. And of course, this function depends on gamma. And it has a very nice property. It's Z4 equivariant, which means that so Z4 is the cyclic group on four elements, and Z4 equivariance means that if I take a four tuple and look at the image of this four tuple, so the four edge lengths and the two diagonal lengths, then if I use the symmetry here, namely if I relabel the four vertices cyclically, this will also change accordingly the right hand side. So it means nothing more. So there's the natural group action here, namely the cyclic group action, and here it's also the cyclic group action on R4, and the generator of D4 will also change R2, and then this map is equivariant with respect to D4, the Z4 action. So how does the Bordism argument now work? So suppose we are given this curve, and we now deform this curve to an ellipse by an isotopy, say an ambient isotopy, or if you don't believe that this exists, because this theorem that you can always deform a given Jordan curve to an ellipse is already rather complicated. So it's in a discrete fashion the Carpenter's rule problem, and you can also do it in R4 or so. So go in higher dimensions, and then you can do this deformation easily. And During this, let's see how this map F changes during this isotopy, during this deformation. So first, say this is P4. We map to R4 times R2. Oh, and actually, why do we look at this map? Because we can say what the squares are by just this map, because the set of squares is parameterized in P4, namely it's the set of all pre-images of a two-dimensional vector space here. So here we have a two-dimensional vector space, say V, which we define as the set of all fixed tuples where the first four entries are the same and the last two entries are the same, say D and D, such that A and D are arbitrary elements in R. Okay, so this is a two-dimensional subvector space of R6, where the first four coordinates are the same and the last two coordinates are the same. If we take the pre-image, it's exactly the set of all squares. And so here we have RLV in it. So the pre-image will hopefully be a non-empty set. What's the dimension of the pre-image? I claim it's zero-dimensional. Why? V is of dimension 2. This is a six-dimensional space. So V has co-dimension 4. P is four-dimensional. So the pre-image will, if this map is transversal, so if this map F here is transversal to V, then the pre-image will be a co-dimension 4 manifold. So since this is four-dimensional, it will have dimension 0. Okay. So it's in general, this is a finite set of points. Now, during this isotopy from the given curve to an ellipse, we get at every time such a test map. So this map is called test map. So for every time, this axis here is the time parameter in the cylinder. We get here a map. So the first map is F of gamma, and the last map on the bottom here will be F of the ellipse. And for an ellipse, we know exactly how the pre-image looks like. It's just one square. Every ellipse has just one inscribed square. Well, it has a lot of them. It has four, because we have a Z4 orbit of those squares. It's because if we have one square like this, we can relabel the vertices. But here in this picture, I just draw the orbits under the Z4 action. So how does the pre-image on the cylinder look like? Well, because it's now five-dimensional, the pre-image will have co-dimension 4, so it's one-dimensional. So it's a set of paths and circles, maybe like this. So what do we see from this picture? Since we have here an odd number of points on an ellipse, we will also have an odd number of points on the given curve. And I didn't talk about some technicalities. So for example, why can we assume that this map F is transversal to V? I just claimed that, no, I didn't claim anything. I just did it. I just said that we can assume this. Of course, we cannot. In general, we cannot assume that F is transversal to V. So one trick is to make an epsilon homotopy. So we change this, we perturb this map F slightly by small epsilon homotopy, such that it becomes transversal. This is possible since Z4 is acting freely on the parameter space P4. So we can find such a equivariant homotopy. And then the pre-image of V will be a zero-dimensional manifold, but it's not anymore the set of squares. But the set is close to squares. So the pre-image then, after the perturbed function F, will be a set of epsilon-closed squares, depending on the epsilon that we use to slightly deform F. Yeah. So after that we have to do some approximation argument. If we let epsilon go to zero and we always know that there's an odd number of squares on the given curve, then there exists a square, so we can make a limit argument. And for this, we need, for example, again, that the given curve is in some sense smooth. So this argument works only for smooth curves. But if this was too technical or not understandable enough, I have a very nice animation. It's actually not an animation, it's an applet. So here's a given curve. And if we move, so can you see this? This is the blue thing is always the curve. And if we wiggle this curve, we always get squares on it. And in fact, at some point, new squares will pop up. And what I just said here, in this Bordism argument, they will pop up in pairs. So what I just did here is, first we had, at some time we had one square, and then two new squares popped up. This is the same as when the time goes by. First we have an ellipse, so we have only one square, and at the time when we see this component, two squares pop up. Okay, and yeah, one can do interesting things with this. So, maybe what I should show already now is that if the curve is not injective, then the number can also be even. That may be interesting. But let me show another example with polygons. So the same thing works for polygons. If we have a triangle and one angle becomes 90 degrees, then two new squares pop up, and one of the new squares can vanish together with the old square, like this. Yeah. So just to visualize this, this would correspond to a component in here, which looks like this. First it goes down, then up, then down again. Okay, just to visualize this. So what's now new? Okay, maybe I should use slides. So I guess the proof for smooth curves already. So what happens now for other curves? That's a new theorem, which says that suppose we have an annulus, which means we have a big circle and a small circle, and we take everything. So we take the whole region in between of those two circles, and suppose now our curve lives in this annulus, and it goes around this the small circle exactly once. So it's the generator, or it's a representative of the generator of the fundamental group of this annulus. Then I claim that it inscribes a square, even if the curve is only continuous, and it doesn't even have to be injective anymore. So that's an even stronger openness condition. So that's an openness condition for in the set of all in the set of all maps from S1 to R2, and not only the injective maps. I claim that such curves inscribe a square of size at least square root of 2. So that maybe comes back to your question. So we can bound the size from below. And so this is also the first explicitly known open set of curves from S1 to R2 that fulfill Toeplitz conjecture. And the proof is extremely simple. What you do is you first look at the set S of all squares that has all four vertices in the annulus. And since the annulus, I think I didn't say, at least not orally, what the annulus has to fulfill. The big circle, if this is of radius 1, then the radius of the large circle, if the small circle has radius 1, then the large circle should have radius 1 plus square root of 2 or less. Otherwise, the argument doesn't work. And if we have such an annulus, you should not think of this annulus, but maybe of a thinner one, maybe of such an annulus, then we have two kinds of squares. We have big squares that look like this, and we have small squares that look like this. And I claim that if the annulus is thin enough, then the then these two components of squares that have the property that all four vertices are in the annulus are disconnected from each other. And it's quite obvious to see this for a very, very thin annulus. And it turns out that the condition that I had before, that the small the small radius is 1 and the large radius is 1 plus square root of 2, that this is the best condition that I can get, such that these two components are still disconnected. Actually, at this point, it becomes connected. So if the radius, those radii have this ratio, 1 plus square root of 2, then they become connected, but then we can use the approximation argument again. Anyways, so suppose the components here are really disjoint. How does this look in the Borism argument? So we have that P4 can be replaced by S, actually, or can be intersected with S. And then it's split into two components, namely here the small squares and here the big squares, which are disconnected. And since we have now here an ellipse inscribed in this thin annulus, then the only inscribed square will be big, which means that the Borism will always stay, since they are disconnected, in a big component. So, which means that we have an odd number of big squares inscribed on every curve that represents the generator in this annulus of pi 1 of the annulus. Okay, that's the proof. So it's rather simple. And it would be very, very interesting, at least to me, to know whether this argument can be generalized to other shapes. So, of course, one can maybe look at a square annulus. So take a square of size 1 and another square of size 3, which are somehow concentric in this way. Then the same argument works here, and for triangles the same thing works. I forgot the exact ratio, but it can be easily computed. So this is an open problem. What's with general shapes? So suppose our given curve lies or has a very nice color, maybe like this, and if we can show this, maybe for a small epsilon neighborhood of a given curve, if you can use such an argument like this, maybe some approximation argument will work. I have no idea. So this is a nice thing to think about. Questions? Okay. Okay. Now, what about immersed curves? I've shown you already this example here, and. Jason Cantarella conjectured that there is a precise formula modulo 2 for the number of inscribed squares for immersed curves, which I didn't write down here. He conjectured that it's a certain isotropy invariant of the curve. So so for example, yeah, if we have such a curve and such a curve, then they are isotropy, and so they are isotopic to each other, in the ambient sense. They should have the same modulo 2 number of inscribed squares. But that's not true. So here's a counterexample. And so what's going on is the... Now let me show the animation. It's much better to see what's going on. So I drew those curves by hand or with a computer, but maybe the pictures are wrong. So let me show the animation. Huh? What? The counterexample is the following. Let's take this curve, okay? And now, so these curves are now like this when they intersect, when they have only one, if this is a figure 8, then this is always in the same isotopy class. But now if the angle of the intersection becomes 90 degrees, then a small square pops up. Okay, and this program is more or less correct, up to some approximations. But that's what's going on. So here at the intersection point, it just goes away. And maybe it's also possible to show this with polygons as well. Let me make a nice curve. That's a nice curve. With polygons, it looks like this. But with polygons, something also strange happens. So polygons are not always the best thing to look at. This happens. So if you have a rectangle like this, then the square can jump. Okay. So that's why I prefer smooth curves. But and with polygons, one also doesn't see why the square is popping up slightly. Okay. But what's the right number? I have also slides for this. And let's use slides. That's the theorem. Suppose this is our given curve. And now we check about color the complements of the curve, such that the outer component is white, and so we use black and white. And now we have crossings. Maybe it's hard to... it's better to see that I drew some of the crossings black, namely the ones that I call fat. And I call a crossing fat if the black angle is larger than 90 degrees. Yeah, so at every crossing I have a black and a white angle, and if the black angle is larger than a white angle, I call it fat. And assume that this is a generic curve, so everything what I say now is only for generic curves, so no intersection is, for example, 90 degrees, so exactly, there's no right angled intersection. And the theorem now says that modulo 2, the number of inscribed squares, is the number of fat crossings, plus the number of black components. That's the exact Mathieu number for generic curves. And this also shows that it's because the ambient isotopy doesn't see whether a crossing is fat or not. So the Mathieu number of inscribed squares cannot be an ambient isotopy invariant. And here's the proof. This is our given curve. Let's do a Bordism argument as before. Let's first cut the curves such that we cut every crossing so that the white components become connected. Okay? So at every crossing that we had, we make the white components connected. And then we make the components that we get smaller and smaller, and move them so that they are ellipses on the line. So here's again the animation. It was quite some work. What do we end up with? We end up with a certain number of black components, namely the number of black components that we had. For every ellipse, we get one inscribed square, and there are no other inscribed squares in this picture. So that explains why on the right hand side we had the number of black components. But what happened when we smoothened out a crossing? Well, if you have a crossing like this, then if we smoothen it out in such a way that, the small angles become connected, then we get a new square. If we smoothen it such that the big angles are connected, like here, we don't get a square. And that explains the number of set angles appearing in the right hand side. Okay. Okay, so much for that. And oh, are there any questions or so? I was not made. Yeah. I think I didn't give many details, but the idea should be clear, and the technicalities also work. What about rectangles? This is, from my point of view, the most interesting open problem in this area. Suppose you're given a smooth Jordan curve, so one which is C infinity, say, or if you prefer, piecewise linear. Suppose you fix an aspect ratio R. Do you then find always an inscribed square of aspect ratio 1 to R? And this is completely open, except for if R is 1, because this corresponds then to squares, because rectangles of aspect ratio 1 to 1 are squares. And for smooth curves, we have a proof for the square peg problem. But for this rectangular peg problem, nothing else was known, except there's a proof by Guggenheimer, which is unfortunately, which contains unfortunately a gap. So he proved that topologically, counted with orientations, the number of inscribed rectangles should be the number of rectangles that you get for an ellipse. And depending on how you count, he got, I think, 16, but he counted it with symmetry. So without symmetry for an ellipse, you would have two rectangles. That's what. Oh, did I say Guggenheimer? I meant Griffiths. Griffiths proved this for rectangles, but the number is actually zero, because the signs, if you count with orientations, the signs of one of those rectangles is the opposite of the other rectangle. So the right answer is, if you count with signs, you have zero rectangles inscribed of a fixed aspect ratio in any given Jordan curve. So there's no topological tool at all known so far which could prove the rectangular peg problem. So it would be really, really nice to have a proof for this. And what I want to present in the last minute is not this mod 2 formula for Mohr's curves, because this works in the same way. So as before with the squares, which is a completely different case, because if we count squares modulo 2, it should be something else than if we count rectangles modulo 2, because a square is a degenerate rectangle, but yeah, actually, yeah. So the mod 2 formula for immersed curves, if we count rectangles, is not a generalization of the version for squares, because it would say that the number of squares is zero, because every square is in two ways a rectangle of aspect ratio 1 to 1. Okay, anyways. I want to talk about the partial results for if the aspect ratio is square root of 3. So suppose we are given a curve which is nearly convex in the following sense, that suppose we are going around the curve in, say, mathematical positive sense, so in this direction, then suppose that for every interval the angle that we turn is at most 60 degrees to the right. So we go at most 60 degrees in the wrong direction. So all those angles should be smaller than 60 degrees. Then I call such a rectangle 60 degrees angular convex. So this notation was already used by Raman Karashiev for a similar very interesting problem. And I claim that all of those rectangles which are close to convex, I know it's not too strong, but those inscribed rectangles of aspect ratio 1 to square root of 3. And I don't want to give a proof, but the intuition behind this. So as I said, topologically, there's usually no way to measure the existence of those rectangles, or at least nothing is known. But what we do, what we can do is, we can measure parallelograms. And I'm interested now especially in those where the angle between two diagonals is 60 degrees. And what is known about those parallelograms maybe let's prove this. Let's do such an Bordism argument again. So this is again P4, but now we are taking a different map F, namely the one that measures 60 degree parallelograms. That's how I call those things. How do we measure this? It's not really important. So for example, you could measure this angle, which would map to S1, and then you measure somehow whether maybe you measure the difference between this and this edge and this edge. So we get the vector in R2. And then we take a pre-image of 60 degrees, comma, 0, comma, 0, which has, what is important, codimension 3. So the pre-image here will also have codimension 3. So we get a one-dimensional family of those parallelograms. Yeah. So a one-dimensional family is a union of circles, and what's the set of 60 degree rectangles on a circle? If gamma is just the unit circle, it's also just a circle like this. So it's basically it represents a particular class in the equivariant one-dimensional Bordism group of P4 with respect to the Z4 action. And this Bordism then looks like maybe like this pair of pants or so, and then we have here donuts or so. Yeah, it looks something like this. So topologically, one can measure this set. So in particular, you will always find the component of 60 degrees rectangles on the inscribed curve, such that if you follow one point on along this component, it will wind around an odd number of times. That's when one gets out of those topological considerations. And why is 60 degrees interesting? If you have a rectangle where the angle is 60 degrees, then the aspect ratio is 1 to square root of 3. That's maybe I should have told you this earlier. Sorry for this. So square root of 3 is not interesting. 60 degrees is interesting, because if you have one component, so a one-dimensional family of those parallelograms on a given curve, then it will intersect itself in the following sense, that if you would trace this diagonal, which, actually those diagonals are lying not only in S1 times S1, but in the quotient with respect to the Z2 action, which just that changes these two points. So it's lying in the Möbius strip. And there will be a component, there will be an odd number of components of those 60 degree parallelograms that turn an odd number of times around this Möbius strip. And any two such components let's wind around in odd number of times, will have common diagonals in the following sense, that that they intersect like this. So every such odd component will to every pair of those odd components, we will find an odd number of situations where they intersect like this, namely that the one diagonal is the other diagonal of the other 60 degree parallelogram. And what do we get out of this? Well, when do we get such a rectangle? This is when the skinny parallelogram becomes a fat parallelogram. At some point in between, it must become a rectangle. So if say if this angle here is larger than pi over 2, so larger than 90 degrees, and it intersects with the same component, we have here also more than 90 degrees, maybe in the same component, then this gives us another 60 degree parallelogram, maybe this one, which then is not anymore skinny or so, it's fat, so it flipped around. And if all those 60 degrees parallelograms belong to the same family, then yeah, we know that in this one-dimensional family, it had to flip at some point, so we get a rectangle. But the intersection pattern can be quite complicated, and the only curve for which I know how to control those intersection pattern is this family of 60 degrees angular convex curves. Okay, this should just be a sketch. For more, you can maybe, ask me later. So, okay. Thank you very much.